from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in Forums next hour, we'll spend the hour with award-winning writer Hugh Raffles, who has written a book of original and offbeat essays all about bugs. It's called Insectopedia. How do you react to insects? With fascination? With revulsion? And does it depend on the insect? Well, Hugh Raffles challenges us to think about insects from a range of different historical, scholarly, and aesthetic points of view and takes us into the worlds of bees, fruit flies, cockroaches, and spiders, as well as alerting us to bigger questions such as what we learn about our own species from the insect world. Hugh Raffles joins us in studio for the hour after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Hugh Raffles is an environmental scientist who teaches anthropology at the New School in New York. He was an anthropology professor at UC Santa Cruz, and he's the author of In Amazonia, which is a natural history, and it received the Victor Turner Prize in Ethnographic Writing. His essays have been published in Best American Essays, in Granta and Orion, and he's a recipient of the 2009 Whiting Writers Award. His most recent book of unusually offbeat but highly original essays is a 26-chapter, that's by Alphabet, collection called Insectopedia, which takes us into the world of insects and makes us think and learn in entirely new ways about bugs of many varieties. And as I said to him before we went on the air here, I've no one so fascinatingly writing about the world of insects since E.O. Wilson, who mainly writes about pismires, which is one of those great words that I love to use on the air, which means ants. Hugh Raffles joins us in studio for this hour. Good to see you. Good
nice
to have
lot,
you.
Michael. Great to be here.
Well, you want to make us like insects, don't you?
I want to make us think about them again and recognize how important they are in our lives and how present they are in our lives.
But not only in terms of the ecosystem, which everybody who has studied biology recognizes. They share our beds. They share our foods, as you point out. They're complicated creatures, and we ought to see them for sort of their ontological reality.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah, I want us to, I mean, I started off, I suppose, with the thought that insects are so much around us. We know how many of them there are. We know how varied they are, but we actually don't know very much about them as animals. Most people don't even think of them as animals. They seem to occupy their own category, and they're very, I don't know how I'd say it, something like very inscrutable.
Well, we learn about a lot about them. They become less inscrutable, thanks to you, but it's that mysteriousness that kind of fascinates you, the interior life of what might be the interior life of an insect.
That's right, yes. And I spent a long time at the beginning of the book trying to figure out how I might get inside an insect psyche, something like that, and figure out, if you like, what the world looked like if you were an insect. And which sounds like a difficult project. Actually, it turned out to be an impossible project. I pretty much gave up on that. Although, if you start with trying to figure out what an animal's senses are and how they're different from ours, then you can get some way towards imagining what the world is like from where they stand.
Well, talk about senses. I mean, cockroaches have 10,000 sensors on their antenna. How can you? Yeah. The mind can't get around that.
Well, that's the problem. It really can't. But you know, there are some things that you could start to think about in I think in some interesting ways. For instance, you know, if you go to, there's this very common thing, if you go to natural history museums, you often find these, and I read about this a little bit in the book, you often find these helmets, and they're mainly for kids, but, you know, if you get inside them, they have faceted lenses, and the idea is that you can see the world as an insect would see it, you know, like a bee would see it, or a fly or whatever, and, you know, through compound eyes. But as I, you know, that intrigued me at the beginning, and then as I thought more and more about that, I thought, wow, you're not really seeing very much. I mean, you're seeing this fractured image, but that's not really telling you how an insect sees, because, of course, you know, there's this distinction between the physical act of vision and then what happens in the process of interpretation through interpretation of those images in your mind.
There are also all those things that insects do that we can't comprehend, I mean, that you get into here. I mean, why bees do the dances that they do, for example, and how spiders build webs. And I mean, these are really ultimately very inscrutable.
Very inscrutable. And that the mystery of them and, if you like, the wonder of them is something that has only grown larger over the time that I've been writing the book. So I started off not knowing very much. And then as I knew more and learned more, I became sort of more in awe, I think, more in awe of the things that they can do and of how surprising so much of what they do is. Bees are really a great example of that. You know, we think of bees as being very busy, but bees spend something like 40% of their time doing, not really being very busy at all. They're in their nests.
Being indolent,
the opposite of busy bees. They're just sort of hanging out with each other, just doing stuff that we don't really know what it is. And, you know, we can interpret it in some sort of evolutionary ways so that it, you know, benefits something or other that leads to reproduction and helps them. But helps them in that kind of way. But that doesn't really tell us very much about it. It's a little bit like saying that, you know, I don't know, we have sex to reproduce the human race or something. You know, I mean, well, yes and no. I mean, it doesn't really tell us very much about, you know, about... It doesn't tell us very much beyond that. I mean, there's a lot more complicated things going on than that.
Well, so much of this is complicated. In fact, you mentioned the great deconstruction of Jacques Derrida's idea of cross-species sympathy. Do insects suffer is really the question. People like Peter Singer, and in fact, I remember reading that Charles Manson, who was okay with killing people, used to avoid stepping on ants because he was empathic to the idea that somehow ants were creatures that should be respected. Uh-huh. But you take a position here. I mean, in effect, you say it's almost paternalistic to think that way, since insects have no central nervous system, and we have to regard them in maybe a different way, but nevertheless regard them as beings.
I think so, yeah. I tend to agree with people who think that our relationship with animals of all kinds should be based first on a recognition of how different they are from us and the differences, and then start from there to try and establish some kind of connection, so that we can build relationships based in respect, but beginning from a recognition that they're not the same as us.
Many people would feel exactly the way you do, but they would exempt bugs from that. Bugs are pests.
Yes.
You know, they think mosquitoes, flies, they're something to get rid of. They carry disease, they bite, they cause malaria, you know, and so forth.
Yeah.
I'm talking specifically about diptera now,
right,
flies
right.
and mosquitoes. But
right.
I used to think, what would happen if flies and mosquitoes just disappeared? You know, would we be better off? Would we be worse off? I remember a science fiction story that said somebody went back to the original time when the first fly got rid of the first house fly and came back in time, there were huge monsters roaming the earth.
Right.
I mean, it's a little parable of sorts, but
yeah.
Do we
yeah.
need them, really, is I guess the question.
Do we need them? That's a good question. Do we need them? Well, do we as people need these other animals, I suppose?
Do our species need
yeah.
those pests that we think of as pests?
Well, I suppose I wouldn't want to place us so much at the center of creation, the center of the world, to make that the important question. I'd like to think of ourselves as living among all these other animals, rather than being the beings that get to make the choice of, you know, what gets to survive and what doesn't get to survive.
Well, you also make a good point about how insects have been used as a metaphor for killing people. I mean, not only the Nazis with Jews as lice, but the Tutsis in Rwanda, talking about these cockroaches, the Hutus, and so forth. I mean, it just shows how maybe we need a different attitude toward insects.
Yeah, I think so. But that what you're describing there, I think, is common to something which is commonly done with all kinds of animals, not just with insects. Insects fit the bill because they are, you know, they're often despised.
So rats would be a good example.
But rats, other kinds of vermin would be a good example, yeah. But, you know, it's this process of turning people into these despised animals in order to treat them as those animals. And we've seen that happen, you know, again and again in history, and actually recently, you know, with Tutsis in Rwanda and cockroaches, as you say. But the example that I talk about is with Jews and lice. But Jews were also referred to as cockroaches and as rats, and you know, I think we're pretty familiar with that. One of the interesting things about the example of Jews is that there was also this very strong connection to what was actually physically done to Jews. So they were, you know, in gas chambers, they were treated with, or I suppose, or just killed with, a gas that was actually insecticide. Cyclon B was an insecticide. They were taken into gas chambers that they were told were delousing facilities, and told were showers. So they were actually taken through these procedures that were familiar at the time, because there was already this practice of delousing immigrants into Germany in this period and treating them very violently. So
well,
people were used
big,
to this kind of thing.
Big flap, as you probably know, just over the weekend about one of Pope Benedict's chief lieutenants comparing the Holocaust to what's been happening in the Catholic Church, but somebody put out on the internet a priest repellent, you know, that looks like a pesticide. Huh. And it's to keep away from altar boys would be sprayed with this, presumably, and they would keep priests away. So it has been translated in some fashion. It gets down to kind of a basic question, though, here. I mean, from your work, what do we learn about our own species, not to be species-centric, from insects, from the insect world?
Do you mean in terms of, well...
What are the most important lessons for you, I mean, who has done a lot of study and has really... brought so much knowledge about the insect world to us.
What I've been interested in is thinking about, and this isn't to avoid your question, but I'll get back to it. But what I've been interested in is trying to think about the worlds that come into being because of insects, or that's one way to think about it, or because insects. If you think of insects as being at the center of something, then all these things come together because of them, all these things start to happen, so that, you know, there's all these, what I've tended to do is look at situations where insects have been very important and have gathered around them all these people and other things, and have led to all these kinds of activities. So, you know, there's the example of the cricket fighting in Shanghai,
for instance. Fascinating. I mean, cricket fighting, a lot of people in the West just don't even know about that. You know,
no, people really don't know about that over here, I don't think, except, you know, people do it and it's still a popular activity in Chinatowns in the U.S. So people do it, and I think people in Chinatowns know about it. But it's not widely known outside that, no.
And yet, in fact, you get into some of these fetishes, like the crush freaks in your book. You get into insect homosexuality. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many things that kind of translate from their world to ours and our world to theirs.
Yeah. Insects are very fascinating to look at, and it's one of the things that became obvious to me in doing the book was how the category of insects itself seems to just disguise a lot of the variation and variety that's possible, and that you find when you start looking at them. I think maybe this is the reason why I have such difficulty answering a question like what can we learn from insects, because they're so varied. We learn a lot from all these different situations.
Well, I learned some very disturbing things when you write about, for example, the Chernobyl insects, or insects in Switzerland near nuclear power plants.
Yeah,
I mean, these are like serious warnings.
I think so. This is...
I mean, tell us about that, just so listeners know what we're talking about.
This is a chapter about a woman called Cornelia Hesse-Honegger, who is a Swiss artist who, for the past 30 years or so, has been collecting insects particular insects, they're little leaf bugs. Very small, they're about 3 to 5 millimeters, that she's collected. Originally, she just collected them in her garden, and then she started collecting them around nuclear power stations in Switzerland. Switzerland's supposed to have the cleanest nuclear power stations in the world. And what she was finding was that there are all kinds of deformities amongst these insects, because she was very familiar with them. You know, she seemed to have been looking at them a long time. And they would be things like misshapen antennae, misshapen feet, damaged wings, all kinds of deformities, which are very hard to spot unless you knew the insects very well, but of course were very significant to the insects themselves. And she started to map them in relation to the movement of radionuclides from power stations. And so she would find that there was much higher incidence of them, you know, on the downwind path from these power stations. And then she also started traveling. So she went to Chernobyl, she went to Three Mile Island, she went to a bunch of different places. And she's had a lot of trouble getting her work recognized and taken seriously by people in the scientific community.
Why do you suppose that is?
I think for a variety of reasons. In Switzerland, I think it's had something to do with, a significant amount to do with her gender. I think it's also because she's not credentialed as a scientist. She's not. She doesn't have the institutional background. She doesn't have a PhD. She's not, you know, formally a scientist. I think that's had a lot to do with it.
She's an artist.
She's an artist.
She's made these images quite vivid, though, and real.
Very vivid. And actually, she's going to be in an exhibition at Swissnecks on Montgomery Street starting on Wednesday, so people can see her paintings there. And they're very beautiful, very striking. They're really like insect portraits, I think I describe them as. And then they have the ones I know anyway, I don't know if they'll be like this here, but they have little captions describing the deformities that you can see and where they were collected. So there's a strange combination because they're very dispassionate to look at, but at the same time, they really, they form a connection with you, I think, because they make you feel like you're occupying the same world and you're subject to the same dangers.
Well, speaking about connections, I mentioned the crush fetish, which is also kind of fascinating. There are people who actually want to be crushed like bugs. This is part of their psychosexual appetite, shall we say?
You know, I got very interested in people who have intense relationships with insects of all different kinds. And so Cornelia was one of those people. You know, she studied them for so long that she really has this very close, intimate relationship with them and is very personally attached to them when she sees them being, you know, when she sees them with these deformities. It has a great effect on her. But basically crush freaks are guys who get turned on by seeing women crush small objects. And how people have described it to me is as a intense identification with the object that's being crushed, which in some cases is insects, which is what I'm writing about, but can be all kinds of things, you know, very specific things.
Small animals, whatever. Yeah.
Very tiny things. Yeah. It could be soft fruit, or it could be, you know, cakes or whatever it might be. But people put themselves... I guess there's probably a lot of difference in how people respond to this, but people I talked to said that they would put themselves in the position of the object being crushed. And so they would have this very, very intense sort of identification at the moment of crushing and seeing women crush these animals or whatever it might be.
We're talking, if you've just joined us, with Hugh Raffles, the author of Insectopedia. Why did you decide to do this in the alphabetical way that you did this? I know you've been asked that many times, but what prompted it?
Well, partly it was because there's just so many insects. They're so impossible to sum up in a book. And I found that really, really fast, really, really quickly, that I wanted to... Well, two things. One, I wanted to signal that... that there was the impulse to do that and to say everything possible there was to say about them, but that it was a completely impossible project. So the idea of the encyclopedia or the insectopedia is sort of tongue in cheek, I suppose, and that's why the chapters are not like A for aphids, B for beetles, C for cockroaches, or whatever. But you know, they have these very arbitrary kind of titles like Air, Beauty, Chernobyl. But that was one part of it. But the other part was that I really like writing within a constraining structure, even though it's a very painful thing to do, especially when you're halfway through and you know you've got to do all 26 letters. Right?
It's like a poet using a sonnet or a villanelle or something like that.
Like that. I think it pushes you to be, the constraints push you to be more creative than you might be otherwise. Yeah.
Talking again about this cross-species phenomenon, you quote Thomas Hunt Morgan as saying, fruit flies are noble beasts.
Yeah,
I mean, that sounds almost silly on the face of it, but fruit flies have served us well, certainly, in science and all that.
There's something very interesting, I think, about animal scientists or people that I've met and talked to and read about, or whose work I've read, in that there's, on the one hand, their experiments demand that they do things to these animals that are really quite brutal. And you can see that with the fruit flies. I mean, millions and millions of fruit flies were killed by Thomas Hunt Morgan in the most casual way, when they were developing when they were gene mapping the Drosophila genome. And Carl von Frisch, who figured out about that these bees danced and the ways that they danced, was also extremely, completely happy to, you know, chop them up and do all glue things to them and all kinds of stuff.
This is the circle dance, waggle dance guy?
Exactly, yeah. But both of them, and many other people too, have these close relationships, very intimate relationships that develop because they're working so closely with these animals, and they get to know the animals' idiosyncrasies. They can see their capacities. They can, you know, they just get to know them. So von Frisch, particularly, he would talk about them as his little friends, his comrades, all this kind of thing. And he got, I would say, he got this great emotional support and, just sort of peace, actually, at a time of great trauma, because this was in the midst of the Second World War in Germany.
This is also the time, as you point out in your book, when Clever Hans, the horse that was responding to mathematics, was very much in the news. So the bees were looked at as being maybe a part of this whole sense of animals being much smarter than we give them credit for.
Well, it was after Clever Hands had been debunked. And, so the bees, I think, and animal ethologists were really struggling against the idea that that animals could be smart at all. There was generally the idea of animal intelligence at that time was very much discredited. It's really only, I think, in the last few years, again, that it's come back, and because of people like Donald Griffin and other people, that it's starting to be taken seriously again.
Well, we use our own standards of intelligence with animals. That's part of the problem, isn't it?
It's really part of the problem. Yeah, we expect them to be able to do the things that we do when they're much better at doing things that we can't do and have no interest in doing.
We're talking again with Hugh Raffles. This book is Insectopedia. And, I keep thinking of what the images of the world after the apocalypse, and it's always the cockroaches, Or you think about famine, and as you point out in your book, you associate locusts as being vital, but also, I mean, to eat, but also vicious in terms of the attacks that that take place and so forth. So insects are maybe kind of microcosmically almost a metaphor for our own world in many ways that we don't even – I mean, look at Kafka, The Metamorphosis, things like that.
Well, they've certainly been taken for that in literature, haven't they? And they appear again and again in different forms. And the social insects particularly have been – what we've tended to do is take our own ideas of human societies, put them onto the social insects and describe their societies in human terms, and then read back the way they behave onto human societies to make judgments about the ways that human societies should be. So in that way, they've been very powerful metaphors. They were very important during the Cold War, for instance. The socialist societies were constantly compared to the mindless automatons of of bee society and ant society.
Or ant colonies particularly.
Yeah, ant colonies particularly. Yeah. So they've been enrolled into political projects a lot as well in those ways.
Is it helpful for us, because, you've done this really, to look at the world through insect eyes, as you put it, without just that helmet, as you said?
I think so. I think there's something important about adjusting our vision to something very small, and developing the patience and the care and just taking the time to look at these very tiny things and to look at the way that they live. One of the chapters that I like writing most was based on field work that I did in Japan. And that was some of the people that I talked to there were insect collectors. And there was one man in particular, a man called Yuro Takeshi, who's very well known in Japan as a neuroscientist. And he writes sort of popular critiques of Japanese society. And he's also an insect collector. He collects beetles. And he talked about the value of developing what he called mushy eyes, or insect eyes. And he described that to me as, he said that, well, if you think about it, it's not just that every tree is different to an insect, but to the beetles that he was collecting, but every leaf is different. And you see things, if you start to take the patience to look at the beetles and see the differences between them, start to imagine what it's like in the way that they live their lives, and they see this very, very, finely grained difference between things. But at the same time, you're able to back off and think about the ways that they're affected by, say, environmental changes or the ways that they live socially and all these kinds of things. He feels that, and I agree with him, that you can extend this sort of sympathy and this awareness of both very small differences and the ways that large differences then have an effect on those small differences. You can extend that to your thinking generally about life, your relationships with people.
Again, our guest is Hugh Raffles. The book is Insectopedia. I'm going to open the phone lines and find out our listeners, what do you think about the world of bugs? Questions or comments? Welcome. Toll-free number 866-733-6786. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Hugh Raffles. He's here with us in studio. He's the author of Insectopedia. And this evening, he'll be at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park at 7:30, tomorrow, 7 o'clock at Bookshop West Portal, San Francisco, and Wednesday at Bookshop Santa Cruz at 7:30. And he's former professor at Santa Cruz of Anthropology, now teaches at the New School, and is also the author of In Amazonia. Getting our listeners involved in this is really a question of, what do you think of insects? I mean, it kind of boils down to that. Are you sympathetic with the idea that they're creatures all like all the rest of us and deserve our empathy and, our consideration and all that? Or do you view them as pests and perhaps so small that they're really immaterial to our own world. I'm just going to read something from the early part of Hugh's book where he says, imagine an insect. That's also a good question. What comes to mind? A housefly, a dragonfly, a bumblebee, a parasitic wasp, a gnat, a mosquito, a bombardier beetle, a rhinoceros beetle, a morpho butterfly, a death's head moth, a praying mantis, a stick insect, a caterpillar. Such varied beings, so different from each other and from us, so prosaic and so exotic, so tiny and so huge, so social and so solitary, so expressive and so inscrutable, so generative and so opaque, so seductive yet so unsettling. Pollinators, pests, disease vectors, decomposers, laboratory animals, prime objects of scientific attention, experimentation and intervention, the stuff of dreams and nightmares, the stuff of economy and culture, not just deeply present in the world, but deeply there, creating it too. So you are welcome to join this program. In fact, you're cordially invited with any questions or comments. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. You can also join us by email, forum@kqed.org, or you can post a comment on our website simply by visiting kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. And let's find out what's on your minds. Richard, good morning.
Hello, Richard from Occidental. You're talking to?
I believe that's who you are, yes.
All right. I didn't make it onto the last program. I think when people talk about insects, they fail to notice the most basic thing about what wondrous beings they are. If a scientist in the best laboratory in the world were trying to make a creature that could walk, fly, sense the world around it, and make decisions based on what it senses, driven by inner mysterious drives that we can hardly even begin to conceive of, they couldn't even get to first base. You look then at a creature like the common housefly that people just turn up their noses at. A fly can see all around it, and it can fly in the most complex, dodgy way that entails instantaneous decision-making at a rate that the best human athlete could never begin to get anywhere near.
Richard, you sound like a strong admirer of insects.
I'm a strong admirer of the natural world and the wonders of creation. And to turn up your nose at one corner of creation, and especially one that's obviously as miraculous as insects, it's just really missing the point.
Well, you can mention the miraculousness of something like a housefly, but I don't know if it's turning up the nose to think they do carry disease. So, you know, when they come and join you at a meal you're feasting on, you don't necessarily want their company.
Well, people can oppress you, too. They can beat you up, kill you. They can do a lot of different things. But they're still miraculous beings that can walk and talk and move and do nasty things, if that's what they're driven to do.
Well, you sound like a kindred spirit to some extent of you, Hugh Raffles, doesn't he?
Yeah,
the kind of wonder he expresses.
Yes, he does. And houseflies are actually very interesting as well. Well, you know, in all the ways that Richard says, but also it's actually quite recently that we've had these such dismissive attitudes towards them. I think about it was only about 100 years ago that we started thinking about them like that with the development of germ theory. Before that, houseflies, and you can find plenty of evidence of this in children's books and things like that. Children's mothers would encourage, or parents would encourage children to make friends with houseflies. Even when they're sitting eating, they would encourage them to bring, you know, to attract houseflies.
Is it a European phenomenon, or is all of them?
European and North American. Yeah. But actually also, the only other place I know about this is in Japan. And when the tide turned against houseflies, which, as I said, was with the development of germ theory, and it was because, it was because of research done by Walter Reed, the U.S. Army doctor. And they traced the footprints of houseflies. They provided these very, very graphic images of the footprints of houseflies carrying disease, walking across plates of food and what have you.
Well, they breed in dung, and I mean, we don't have to get too specific here, but they do carry disease.
They're most likely to catch disease from another human, because they carry kindred types of pathogens.
I think that's probably quite true.
That's probably true. Yeah.
Quite true.
Thank you, Richard.
Yeah.
Good to hear from you this morning. Let's hear from some more of our listeners. We'll go to Martinez. Melissa, good morning.
Oh, good morning. This sounds like a fascinating book, and I want to go rush out and go get it.
Oh, thank you.
Our family, my father was an amateur naturalist, and he raised my brother, my sister, and I to really love and appreciate insects. We actually spent hours and hours and hours of our childhood hunting them, not to capture and keep, but just to see them and really appreciate them and love them. We looked under rocks for things like salamanders as well.
That's great.
And I actually thought once at one point that I had discovered a new fly. In the woods, it was the most adorable little thing, you know, with this articulated head, and I'd never seen it before. I did have a question, which comes in sort of the form of a story. I, at one point, was in a very, very large theater auditorium with about 600 people on Maui, and a large butterfly came in and flew up toward the skylight. And I told it in my mind that if it came back down to me, I would take it back out again. And indeed, within about, I'd say 20 minutes, it fluttered back down and came to rest on my knee, and I took it outside. And I know most people don't believe my story, but it is true. And I wonder, do you have any experience or have you heard of other stories where people sort of communicate with insects and feel like there actually is a communication going on?
Oh, certainly, yes. But the best example I have it are these people I talk about who train crickets in Shanghai who I met. And some of those people who've been working with them for a long time can communicate verbally with crickets, and they do that.
Or claim they can, at least.
Well, it looks to me as if they can. It's not just verbal commands. It's verbal, and also they're using these little straws, which they use to stroke the animal. But they take it through, like exercise regimens by giving it orders, and the cricket will respond to those orders. I think they certainly have, communication of all kinds. Yeah,
well, I think. Thank you for the call, Melissa. It was Jung who was talking to a patient. He said he had a dream about a butterfly or a moth or something, and then a scarab appeared right in the. Suggesting something maybe preternatural or. Some kind of communication not understood. But it's funny how people don't think of like butterflies as being insects. I mean, ironically, because maybe they're too pretty to be insects or something.
We often think, the term really gets tied to the insects that we have negative feelings towards mostly, doesn't it?
Yeah. I'm going to go to some of your emails. By the way, if you'd like to join us, you can do that toll-free at 866-733-6786 or by email, forum@kqed.org, or you can post a comment on our website just by visiting kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. Here's Lee who writes, scientists have been studying the algorithms ant colonies use to function as a kind of meta-organism and found that these algorithms can be used in software. One example is what FedEx might use to determine delivery truck routings. Could your guest comment on what's being done with these? Do you know?
Oh, really interesting. No, I don't know very much about that at all, actually. I mean, I know people who claim that there are these, very simple algorithms which can explain the basic movements of insects, and that insect behavior can be reduced to these very simple algorithms. People who've worked with artificial intelligence and with robots often work along those using those kinds of principles. I'm not able to talk in any detail about that, except I agree it's very fascinating.
It is fascinating. And here's Graham who says, do insects sleep? Do they have a sleep cycle? And if so, what percentage of their life is spent asleep? You were talking before about lazy bees.
Yeah.
What about sleeping?
Well, these are difficult questions for me to answer because I'm not an entomologist. They do sleep. They rest. They have rest periods. There are people who are doing this basic research on this. One of the things that I think is quite interesting about insects is that research on insects in general is limited to a very small number of species and to a relatively small number of topics as well. Maybe more than most animal research, it's often driven by the demands of funded by the military, for research. The applications are often in weapon systems. And that's because of the certain characteristics that insects have. Their swarming characteristics, for instance, with locusts and other swarming insects. The kinds of vision skills that, or vision capacitors that it's often with flying insects that flying insects have. So we see a lot of this research being funded for military applications. But
they were studying spiders just from the aeronautics of what they're capable
for
of.
For aeronautics and also for NASA has been studying them for the for tensile strengths of webs, of their webs and stuff like this. So I think a lot of people who want to do basic research on insects find that that's how their research is getting funded.
Here's a listener named Max who says, Kafker, the German African word for bug, is still a common racial slur. I think that's correct. Kafker Boy, famous novel out of South Africa. Another listener writes, insects are a critical part of our ecosystem. Birds and bats rely on them, and many, many, many plants need them for pollination. Mm-hmm. The world of life is not homocentric. And Carmine says, I've heard that locusts are good food. Is it possible to husband them for protein? Also, if they're edible, why have people not harvested them during the plagues? Well, they are edible.
They are edible, actually, and I have a chapter on that in the book.
Yes.
They're certainly edible, and people do collect them and sell them. And in certain countries, the one that I read about is Niger, there's a developed market in selling them for food. And there are a number of different species, so it's not all the species that are the dangerous swarming locusts that are the that are edible.
Have you tasted them?
Yeah.
Like chicken? Is that, that's what they say about it anyway.
Crunchier.
From Corte Madeira, Chris, good morning.
Good morning, hi. I've always been interested in people's reactions to ladybugs.
Mm.
Just that little bit of orange pigment changes it from a hideous black beetle to this wonderful thing that they'll let crawl over their bodies and their fingers, and they go out of their way to collect. And they won't even chase them away. They'll let them wander around.
And that are symbols of good luck to so many people. Ladybugs.
Yeah. Exactly. And are there other examples of insects that a little bit of pigment, a little bit of personality makes them more palatable?
Yeah. I mean, it's all cosmetic, isn't it? I mean, those slight changes and the ways that the good examples are pretty. You know, the prettier dragonflies are much more appealing, and they generate much more much more emotional attachment than flies that are that are not colored. It's a point I don't really know what more to say about it, but it's absolutely true. I mean, the attractive insects generate much more attachment from us, and we're much more appealing to us. And one of the big divisions that we have is between the insects that look appealing and the ones that don't. But it's a bit complicated, I suppose. I mean, it depends how we look at them. If we look really closely at, even if we look closely at butterflies, and Primo Levi, the writer, talks about how even the most beautiful butterfly has a diabolical face if we look at it closely. So I think for some people it's the difference that they're just so, even the insects that when you look at them very quickly, or you look at them just and see the colors and the prettiness of them, are immediately appealing. If you look more closely at them, they're still so alien to us that it's hard to find them appealing.
I know you've mentioned that you're not an entomologist, but I believe it's true that we don't even know, nor have we garnered the great proportion of species of insects that are out there.
No, not at all. And there's examples of people going to famous studies that people have done going to the Amazon and just pretty much just shaking a tree and finding, huge numbers of new species just from what's come down out of the tree. One of the really, I suppose, fascinating things about insects is that it's not just that the ones that we know are unknown, but there are so many out there that actually we don't even have any. There's no way to calculate the numbers that we don't know, of course.
Here's a listener who says, hello, Hugh and Michael. I'm a grad design student at the California College of the Arts and have been researching and promoting entomophagy. That's the human consumption of insects.
Mm.
He's been promoting this for the last couple of years. It's currently a large part of his thesis and wonders, Well, so through my research, I've learned of the relationship between humans and insects, especially as food is definitely complex and interesting. So I was definitely excited to hear when your book came out. So what I wanted to ask was, what do you think about the possibility of people in the U.S. seriously adopting entomophagy?
Well, you know, I'm sorry about this, but my response would be I'm vegan, and so I'm not really enthusiastic about encouraging people to eat animals of any kind. But I know there's an argument that, you know, they're a good source of protein and they're underutilized and what have you, but I prefer to think of them as animals like other animals who should be treated with treated not just as food, I suppose, for us. I think there's plenty of other things that we can eat without eating animals.
Another listener named Chuck says, I understand that we grossly underestimate the sheer quantity of insects in the world, both in numbers and total mass. Could your guest comment on that?
That's absolutely correct, yeah. And as I was saying, it's not just that we underestimate them, but we don't really have any good basis for knowing what a correct estimate should be. I mean, there aren't any known unknowns, there's just unknown unknowns in this case, I think.
A lot of interest from listeners about Cornelia Hess-Honegger's work. Mm. Another request that where are these insect portraits are going to be shown in San Francisco again?
Yeah, they're going to be on at SwissNex, which I think is SwissNex, which I believe is on Montgomery Street, but you'd want to check that.
We're talking about houseflies before, and you write about the dance, the sort of deceptive dance rites of the dance fly, really, which is kind of fascinating too.
Yeah, they're very fascinating. These are these little swarming flies that were recognized, I think, first in the the flies have been known for a long time, but in the 1870s, somebody spotted that they were carrying little like silvery envelopes. These are very tiny flies. And it took a while. I think it was really in the 1950s that entomologists started to understand that the different species were, they were carrying, the things they were carrying were these little packages, and the males carried them and would present them to, or they would use them, let's say, I think, yeah, more accurately, they would use them as a way to attract females
by their package.
Yeah, by their package to have sex. And the packages, some of the packages would contain, let me back up a little bit. The packages could be either food, there would be like dead fly, usually, or some other insect. Or they could be wrapped. So it could be a little food thing, which would be wrapped up in the silvery package. Or it could just be the silvery package itself with nothing in it. Or it could be some other little thing, like a little piece of a flower petal or something like this. And they use them to attract the female, but also to, not just to attract her, but also to distract her, because this is one of those species where the female is prone from time to time to, you know, turn around and bite the head off the male while they're having sex. Now, biologists have tended to interpret this as being, they see this as a form of cheating from the point of view of the male. They see the male as providing lesson as the species have evolved. They've seen the gifts getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper.
It's the illusion. It's kind of a come on illusion. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is sort of. I mean, the way that many biologists tell it is that it's some kind of bait and switch.
Yeah.
That they attract the female with, you know, with this thing which looks all glitzy, and it's, you know, like some, I don't know, like some bling thing that they're attracting them with, and then when the
it's like a guy wearing a lot of bling, it turns out to be false.
Exactly.
Zircon rings or whatever.
You know? Yeah, but I'm, you know, as you know from having read this, I take another view on this, which is that maybe the female isn't so stupid, but maybe she actually likes these little packages. Maybe there's something else she likes about them, and it's, you know, there is appealing to her as I don't know, as a dead fly would be.
Which is a little bit heterodoxical. I mean, a position that doesn't go in the mainstream that you've taken.
But it seems to me as convincing.
It seems
as
reasonable,
any other.
Though plausible, okay, certainly. You. Yeah. Let's get a Berkeley caller on. Abby, good morning.
Good morning. Hi. How are you?
Hi.
Hi. I was calling because I was touched by the story the lady told earlier about her butterfly. Hmm. And actually, houseflies are, you know, not particularly appealing, as you've said. But my daughter, who is only little, who's 7, ever since she was very small, for some reason, flies have been attracted to her, and she's been attracted to them. And so she would stand, you know, if she stands next to a window full of flies, like in the summer, you know, you get many, they will eventually all come to her and sit on her hand. And she will just put her hand, she's very still, and she'll stand there, and they'll all come and stand on her hand, and then she'll take them and let them go outside. But it's, what's interesting about this is everyone is really creeped out by it, you know, and they're always like, what a strange little child you have that flies will come to her. You know?
But you know, Abby, there's a, do you know who Chester Gould is?
No.
Chester Gould is the cartoonist who gave us Dick Tracy. You know that name, of course.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And there was a character named Flyface. This goes back way. Flies were attracted to him. I mean, so there are all kinds of, I suppose, negative associations with that.
Yeah, I mean, people sort of look at her as if she is some, you know, sort of changeling, you know, that she's able to, not a perfectly normal child, but she, you know, she has a quality of stillness, I guess, that they like. But, and as a result, she's become fascinated with all insects and butterflies and all that kind of thing. But it is a little weird.
You know, I'm cautious of coming, you know, I mean, I've written this book, but I'm cautious of coming off as too flaky here. But I should tell you that I actually believe that if you are very calm around insects and don't just like reach out and, you know, just react and swat them all the time, then they do behave very differently towards you. And with flies, for instance, you know, often we don't want them in our rooms in summer, you know, we've got an open window and they come in. But actually I find that if you're very, very calm and you know, and you ask them to leave and you sort of like, you know, shepherd them out, they'll actually just leave.
Even if you have some raw meat around? I know
I'm a vegan,
so I can't. Or some good vegetables, maybe, or something like that.
I saw footage one time of what it looks like from a fly's point of view. I can't remember what show it was on, but that everything to them is very slow. You know, we move very, very slowly.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
And, you know, I imagine that we look like giant buildings, you know, coming at them, and no wonder they dart away. But I guess if you're small and quiet, you look appealing.
So your daughter is the fly whisperer.
She is, and in fact, that's what everybody calls her, the fly whisperer.
Really?
And and she's sort of, I think she's as bemused by everyone being freaked out as people are freaked out by her being bemused, if you get my drift. Like,
I get it, Debbie.
There's a moment of misunderstanding, you know, between all of them. But, yeah, who knows, it's handy. In the summer, she gets rid of all the flies.
Thank you for that. Good to hear from you, and we'll move along. We'll go to Robert next. Thanks for waiting, Robert. You're on.
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment. We own a little contraption in our home, which we call the spider catcher, and it's just a stick with a little box on the end of it, and you can use it to capture insects inside your home. And just the process of doing that with my daughter over the years has really developed an appreciation amongst all of us for insects, because we find them in the home and we sit and examine them and we look them up, and then it's a catch and release.
Yeah.
I just wanted to share that.
Thank you.
That's great.
Loads of fun for us.
I appreciate that. And gosh, I remember a former producer of ours, David Minko, saying that he was like you. He was very respectful toward the insect world and thought that they may even have feelings and so forth. And one, he would take a spider and move it out of his house and apologize. One time he said he killed a spider, and the next morning the alarm went off, the radio alarm, and he learned that Raul Julia had died, the man who was the star of this Kiss of the Spider Woman. I thought, there must be some kind of message in this. You know? Here's Tana, who says, I'm fascinated by insects and this discussion. I'm curious about how your guest relates to spiders, ants, flies, moss, etc. in his home.
Mm-hmm.
What about the cobwebs and corners? They build up if you don't remove them, but if you do, aren't you destroying the spider's way to feed?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think we all have to live together. I mean, and we have to find a let's say some kind of way in which we can all be comfortable and just respectful of each other. So there are people I know, actually not personally, but who I've read about, who are very comfortable with just letting their house turn into whatever kind of a home it is for everything that might come in there. I'm not quite like that.
You'll get rid of a cobweb, will you?
You know, I do. I let them build up, but when they get to be too much, I sort of very gently remove them, and I'm very careful not to harm the spider, and I let it build up its cobweb again.
Annie writes, I'm curious about the place of insects in our collective psyche. I'm thinking of how aliens in the film Men in Black are depicted as highly offensive and threatening insects. Are they cockroaches? Or the movie The Fly? We even use the word alien to describe insects. Could it be that insects are simply so different from us that we relegate them to the shadow?
I think that's just right. I mean, you do get counterexamples, and I suppose District 9 would be the the best recent example of that, where the aliens are insects.
That's a really insect good movie.
It's a great, apart from the way they depict the Nigerians, it's great. I mean,
well, it's also, I didn't like the Nigerian depiction either, but it's really symbolic, of course, that it was in South Africa, but it really could be about insect life, as you suggest. We got a Berkeley caller next. Anne, thanks for waiting. Good morning.
Thank you so much, Michael, for this wonderful guest. I just wanted to mention two fantastic programs that have been on PBS, and everybody might want to try to catch them. The first one was several years ago. It was a documentary by The Roots, and it was called Mysterious Castles of Clay about termites. It's fascinating. People will not believe it when they see that. I don't know where they can catch that, but the other one is on this evening, so I really wanted to mention it to everyone who's either interested or passionate, as I am. It is a program, Nature, on 54KTEH, and it's at 7 p.m. this evening, and it's about the fig wasp and the fig tree, and the description is the fig wasp is a vital supplier of life, and I saw it before, and it's unbelievable, and it shows the whole web of life and how it relates to this teeny tiny little insect, and people will be amazed, just absolutely fascinated. And I really wanted to share that with your audience. I hope everybody gets the chance to watch it, record it, whatever. It's incredible.
Well, thank you for bringing that to our attention. It brings up termites. What do you do about termites? I mean, I'm talking about Hugh Raffles now, who takes a spider web out very delicately and is so concerned about all these insects. You're living in a house, you've paid for the house, you're paying mortgage, and you got termites?
Hey, in New York, we don't have this problem.
I know. what do you say to people who do, though? I mean, because you are concerned about the insect world.
Well,
sorry, I don't mean to
put
you in such a tough dilemma here.
But I suppose in general, I think you have to be preventive about these things. I mean, if you don't want them around, is you don't create habitats for them. I mean, we're really living in there.
They like wood.
they like wood, but then you have to be careful to, you know, you have to treat the wood and all this kind of stuff and not get into the situation where you end up killing all these things.
Or as Larry David would say, respect wood. The book, again, is Insectopedia, and good to have had you with us this morning.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
So did I. Monday tonight, he'll be at Kepler Books at 7:30, and tomorrow, Bookshop West Portal, San Francisco at 7, and Bookshop Santa Cruz on Wednesday at 7:30. Thank you all for being with us. Appreciate your listenership. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.